Okay, I'm going to talk to you about a family history. I mean, we said, okay, this might be a way of simplifying it, but just so that you get a sense of it, and I will pass these around and you can have a look at it. This is a family tree of the Hibbert's family operations in Manchester. A family tree of the Hibbert's operations in London. And a family tree of the Hibbert's operations in Jamaica. So there are a lot of them, they're all helpfully called the same thing. Great, good work, people in the 18th century. So if you want to take one each and then pass it on. In terms of thinking about a sort of family history approach to understanding the slavery business, this is something that I've been working on with another teacher, a guy called Dan Lydon-Cohen, and looking at an inquiry, looking at the, it's a family in Liverpool called the Watt family, and he is developing resources looking at how to approach slavery through a single family, and he's using the Watts to develop that and is piloting that material in Liverpool at the moment. So it's something to think about in terms of how you might, you know, potentially think about framing your own interventions in the classroom as well. So the Hibbert family started off life as cloth merchants in Manchester. So I think this is quite an important sort of point to make, is that their initial sort of foray into the world of transatlantic commerce comes through their participation in the cotton trade, basically. So again, thinking about Manchester as being described as kind of slavery's hinterland. So Liverpool being the maritime port most associated with transatlantic slavery, but actually Manchester was thoroughly implicated in this history as well. So in the sort of back end of the 17th century, the Hibberts were working with linen drapers. They eventually moved into sort of sending finished cotton goods to Liverpool for use in the slave trade. They became involved in a sort of a network of families who were resident in Manchester, and all of them are connected through their shared dissenting religious identity. So they're all Unitarians. They are all worshipping at a church, a chapel in Manchester, and they are all intermarried. So there's the, I mean, I won't go into it. It indicates it on here. Sorry, can I borrow that a sec? But you've got the Diggles, Baileys, the Robinsons, and the Phillipses. They are all involved in different aspects of transatlantic commerce. The Diggles are slave traders. The Baileys are, again, cloth merchants. And the Phillipses are involved in all sorts of different West India merchants, the transport of goods, and they're also involved in slave trading as well. So that was the sort of base at which they began in Manchester in the back end of the 17th and early 18th century. So they built up their networks at Liverpool, and eventually Thomas Hibbert Sr. Was sent over to Jamaica in 1734. And I recently found, I hadn't been entirely sure why it was that he had been sent there, but I recently found a reference which said that actually he was going to collect debts owed to the family in Jamaica. And when he got over there, he ended up, he stayed there. He set up a slave factorage business. He went into partnership with a variety of different people, and gradually he ended up establishing himself as he's described in 1790 in the Select Committee to Parliament on the Slave Trade as, kind of, quote, the most eminent Guinea factor in Kingston. And over a 10-year period, he was responsible for transporting around 16,000 enslaved people. At one point in time in the 1750s, he was taking, I think it was about a quarter of all enslaved people coming into Kingston. He was a large-scale slave factor, so he dealt with the kind of sort of premier plantation and slave owners on the island. So people like Simon Taylor, Nathaniel Phillips, and John Tharp, they owned multiple plantations and thousands of enslaved people. And the Hibberts owned, kind of, it's horrible phrasing to use, but sort of warehouse space in Orange Street in Kingston, and that has been identified as a place in which enslaved people were kept for a process of what was described as seasoning. And that process basically was, I guess, sort of a psychological acclimatisation to the reality of permanent enslavement, but also importantly, in terms of the physical condition in which people arrived in, people were kept there to recover from the Middle Passage, also in terms of if people were going to contract diseases, then that would be at the point at which they did it, and then Thomas Hibbert would essentially sell enslaved people on when they were at their prime so that he could get the highest possible price for them. And he knew how to play the market, so there are letters where he talks about, you know, there is a glut of slave ships and so the price goes down, so he would keep people for longer until there was you know, more of a market demand for enslaved people. So we are talking about that kind of language in terms of thinking about people as commodities. In terms of the sort of his kind of progress within the island, he was a powerful slave factor. He also became speaker for the Jamaica House of Assembly. In fact, the House of Assembly actually sat in his merchant house in Kingston. I think I've got a picture of that. Yep, so this is the Hibbert family townhouse in Kingston. It's still standing today. It's now the headquarters of the Jamaica National Heritage Trust, and that's where this image is taken from, so it still hangs in the house today. And as speaker, he was able to have quite a big influence in terms of shaping debates. There was a kind of a tension between the merchants and the planters in the Caribbean, and the Jamaica Assembly was dominated by the planters. So having a speaker who was a merchant was kind of helpful in terms of sort of oiling the wheels of his mercantile business, because it meant that he could prioritise in terms of shaping debates mercantile issues. He went through a variety of different partnerships, but he was successful, if you want to use that phrasing, enough to open up a branch house in Montego Bay when the western side of the island was beginning to be developed more intensively. And so Montego Bay and Falmouth opened up as kind of centres of slave trading activity as well. So in his in terms of the family business in Jamaica, slave factories was a really, really key part of that business, but also really importantly, money lending, credit. So really sort of, you know, irritatingly, because I work on the Hibbert family, Thomas Hibbert's will is missing, so we don't actually know how much money he had at death, but Trevor Bernard, who's a historian of Jamaica, has done some really interesting work in terms of comparing like for like with other merchants who were operating at a similar or lesser than level than Thomas Hibbert. And it was reckoned he was owed around £250,000 worth of debt when he died, which is an absolutely vast sum of money. It would have made him one of the wealthiest men, if not the wealthiest man on the island at that point in time.
Can I ask one that I always find it quite difficult to kind of convey wealth or even comprehend wealth, and I think kids are very quick to jump to that. They're like, oh, what does that mean? Would he have been as rich as this person that they know is wealthy? Is there, like, do you find there's good ways of conveying the extent of the wealth?
Well, you can use different indexes, I think. There's a variety of different indexes of wealth that you can use, and you can translate it online. You can put an amount of money in and it converts it, right? And there's like different ways of doing it. I always normally go for the most conservative translation, because then, you know, you're saying at a conservative estimate it would be. But yeah, there are, I mean, I don't know, do you want to say anything more about that?
Well, I think it's an important question. Most of the public sources, the public history sources, use retail price indices, okay? And that means that you multiply the amounts that Kate's talking about by about 100 into today's terms. Those amounts are not, they don't convey actually the difference, okay? A retail price index just says, what was the price of bread in 1830? What's the price of bread today? But because of the Industrial Revolution and the modernization of British society, we're all much wealthier. For a given profession, you can afford many more loaves of bread. Okay, so what you need to do is to use average wages and use that as a comparison. And then your multiple is 1,000 times. It's 1,000 times. And then Kate's 250,000 is a huge, huge number in today's terms. And we use this average wage approach in the work that we've done with LBS. What happens is that many members of the public come back and say, you've made a mistake. You know, I've always been using X, and I can tell you that you say 20 million £20 million of state compensation money was worth, in today's terms, X. Well, I can tell you that it shouldn't be that. It's really worth £2 billion.
Mm-hmm.
And that debate is an important one to have. But it, average wages is the right, is the theoretically correct way of re-expressing this. Because of house price inflation, for example, it's very difficult to say you could have bought this, whereas now you buy this. But if you use the, it's effectively 1,000 times, give or take.
And how do we feel about like using modern day people as examples in terms of bringing it home to them? Because even then, do you feel like these people are kind of equivalent to certain people today?
I have never thought of that in those terms, but I think it's perfectly legitimate to say he would have been one of the wealthiest 5 men in Britain, and today that would make him equivalent to it. And then you could put the Sunday Times list and find the name that has most significance to an audience.
I mean, in terms of showing that debate to your students, there are loads of sort of online calculators that you can do that actually have multiple different functions, and they can tell you the different ways that you would calculate changes in value, so then you can have that debate with the students. But money lending was very, very important to the Hibbert family. Also, plantation management, or it's sometimes called acting as an attorney, particularly for the younger generations that came out to join Thomas Hibbert Senior. This was how they kind of got their sort of almost like traineeship in terms of their experience on in dealing with plantations, in understanding how the business and the system worked. So they didn't operate in terms of a single management of one plantation. They operated again at a very high level. So they were operating as attorneys on multiple different plantations. And actually, this allowed them to control where the sugar or the commodities on that plantation, where the produce was shipped to. And we'll return to that because they opened up a sugar commission house in London. So they were then able to profit from slave factorage, money lending. They were paid fees to act as attorneys, and then they also sent the sugar from the plantations that they controlled to their own merchant house in London. They also later became involved in... So
what's a merchant house?
Merchant house. So it's a mercantile partnership. So it was mainly family members, but then also they went into partnership with people that could bring knowledge of different aspects of the slavery business. So initially they went into partnership with two men who had experience as ship's captains, so they would be able to handle the sort of the transportation side for the slave produced commodities. So it's important to sort of again kind of reinforce that they didn't go into slave trading because they didn't want to take on the risk of investing in ships that were on the African coast and the kind of risk factor that came along with transporting enslaved people. They transported slave-produced commodities because they felt that that was a kind of safer bet. So it's a distinct difference. Mm-hmm. They did eventually go on to invest in plantation and slave ownership themselves. So their initial purchase was in Ugle to Vale, so that's in St. Mary's, what is modern day St. Mary's in Jamaica, and that was purchased in 1760. And I think it was as they were really entrenching themselves in terms of the kind of the planter merchant elite in the Caribbean. They bought this big plantation, and they bought several of the neighbouring plantations as well, and kind of amalgamated it into a 3,000-acre estate. I think in the initial slave register in 1817, there were over 800 enslaved people working on this estate. So you sort of get a sense of the size and scale of it. And that great big kind of monument that you can see there, that's the monument to Thomas Hibbert Sr., who was kind of considered to be the sort of the colonial founder for the family, but he was one of many generations. I think there were a further 3 generations of Hibberts that went out there. So it was kind of the beginning of the establishment of the family. So the family's success in terms of slave factorage, money lending, attorneyship, plantation ownership meant that they then had the capital to put together a mercantile partnership, a merchant house, in the city of London. And so in 1770, Thomas Hibbert Sr.'s nephew, Thomas Hibbert Jr., opened up a branch house initially they were on Cannon Lane, but they moved to Mincing Lane pretty soon after the mercantile partnership was established. There were lots of different mercantile partnerships operating at the same time from the same premises, but they dealt with sort of slightly different areas of the business. So for example, one of them was interested in, I think we had mentioned Madeira yesterday, they used to ship Madeira wine as well into Jamaica as a kind of a luxury item, and one of the partnerships dealt with that. Their main business was sugar commission, and that was where they made a lot of their money. But they sort of had the whole process sort of stitched up, because they were able to sell the commodities. However, they were also involved in shipping, so they owned part shares in ships. Eventually, they owned their own fleet of ships, and George Hibbert, who is Thomas Hibbert Jr.'s brother, tells a committee, I think the 1820s, that the family was involved with around 8 or 9 ships, which again is a huge expense, but sort of indicates the levels at which they're trading. Importantly, they were involved in insurance. So they insured slave-produced commodities. Thomas and Robert's brother-in-law, Thomas Gregg, was an underwriter for Lloyd's Insurance Company, and that's who they sourced a lot of their insurance through. And it was a very, very close commercial relationship. At one point in time, Thomas Gregg was invited into their partnership, but he actually ended up declining. But it's a very kind of close bond that they have, both in terms of, you know, kind of a shared matrimonial bond, but also a business bond. They owned their own warehouses. They also owned their own quay as well. So when their ships were coming in, they could dock at the private quay and they could use the family's private warehousing space. So it meant they had the edge in terms of the speed with which they could move and process goods. They sold commodities, and again, in London, they were also involved with money lending as well.
Did they insure just slave-produced goods, or were they insuring any slave trading?
So the family in Jamaica, some of them were invested, so that Robert Hibbert Jr., brother of Thomas Hibbert Jr. and Robert Hibbert Jr., did invest in some slave ships and did have to source insurance for some of those things. But he was involved in a sort of partnership outside of the family with the planter Simon Taylor to do some slave trading activities that involved investments in slave ships and insurance of slave ships. But that was like a sort of his project on the side kind of thing. It was not the sort of main business of the family merchant house.
Yeah.
So again, it goes to that idea that sort of there are lots of different partnerships in operation at the same time for different aspects of...
It's like a multinational company today, isn't it? It's all these aspects of production within one overall umbrella.
Well, I think it's important to understand that, you know, prior to multinationals, you know, a lot of finance and business was done through the family companies, and you know, kind of as a result of deregulation, that family structure, am I right in saying this, am I just talking nonsense? As a result of deregulation, that sort of family structure kind of went out, and then you have the development of kind of multinationals and globalised companies.
Yeah, and then the key is the risk in the business. If you're a family partnership and things go wrong, everything goes. And so in the 19th century, it was the evolution of limited liability companies that incorporated, and there'd then be outside shareholders, and you could share the risk. So that was the migration that took place, really, from these mercantile partnerships, as Kate's describing, into an incorporation, into companies that could have many, many shareholders who could share the risk and the returns from it. So that's really what the big picture.
Well, I always like the story of the Boddingtons, because you think, oh, the family structure is more stable for commerce, but then one of the Boddingtons runs off with his cousin's wife, and that was the end of the Boddingtons family merchant house. Okay, so this is an image of, I don't know if any of you have been down to the Museum of London Docklands. This is the decorative pediment on top of what's known as Hibbert's Gate. This is a depiction of one of the family's ships. It's a West India ship, so it's not a slave ship. And it's called the Hibbert's, and it was one of the ships that was used for transporting slave-produced commodities. So you can sort of find an example still of the kind of physical legacy of their business as well. As I mentioned, they sourced insurance. This is sneakily snipped out extract from the business ledger books of Nathaniel Phillips, who was a Jamaica planter. And the top line is an illustration of the fact that they're paying for insurance, so you can actually see it logged on the books there. That's an image of Wiggins Quay, which was the quay that they owned, and an adjacent warehouse space on the Thames. So this image is actually taken from Sir John Soane's museum, and that was because the Hibberts were also involved in the establishment of the West India docks in London. This was a sort of vast project. Many people with interest in the West Indies were invested in this project. It created warehousing space and docks for use for West India ships. People who already owned keys or properties affected by the building of the West India docks were awarded compensation money. So the Hibberts were involved in both the campaign to get this dock built, but they also received £15,000 worth of compensation during the compensation for the dock scheme, because they lost their own private docks as well. So you can see they are profiting from basically every single aspect that they can think of this business. And just finally, this is George Hibbert. He, again, like his uncle and like his brothers in Jamaica, sort of accrued political power in Britain to help bolster the business. So he was an alderman of the City of London, an MP for Seaford, and also the agent for Jamaica, and he was instrumental in terms of the campaign for compensation, and the family received collectively over £103,000 worth of compensation money. So that's the degree to which they were involved in the system. And they received that as trustees, owners in fee, mortgagees, judgment creditors, devisees in trust, and executors. So you get a sense of the different capacities in which they are invested and interested in the slavery business.
Thanks very much, Kate. So somewhere between Kate's case study and then the systemic stuff that I showed you, as I say, there is, I think, a synthesis that would allow clarity in the classroom as to what this business is, which would answer the question, including Sharon's, which is, okay, what is a West Indian merchant house? What is a mercantile house? And what they were doing was importing sugar, never taking ownership of it, but on behalf of the plantation owners, they imported sugar and then sold it. As it came into Britain, they had to pay the sugar taxes, the taxes on import, which were very, very high. So there needed to be big and well-capitalized firms. And then they would enter what they'd sold the sugar for in the account of the slave owner. When they sent him a piano, they would take money out of that account, and that account would run for years and years. And each year, the West India merchant would be taking commission on everything that he did. And he would be charging interest on all the advances that he made. So this is a fundamental part of the slave economy, is this role of the West India consignee, as that diagram was intended to suggest. And as I say, some way of bringing these things together so that we can use the Hibberts, or perhaps the Hibberts is the best example, as the nexus for, a clear explanation of what this business looks like. So what is the system is one of the questions that I think that, in a way, we owe you an answer to, and to help you package that for the classroom. But the other two questions, which are as important, are so what, and how do we think about this or remember it today? And the so what question is, did this matter to Britain at the time? And then the third question is, does it matter to us now, and in what way does it matter?